so happy. I'm very happy to be back home, I want to say. I know most people, but I wonder if there's some new people or people that just don't know me. Are you guys new? Yeah? First time here, or you just you don't know me? Okay. I'm Kokyu's partner. My name is Shoho. And I'm just coming back from 8 months being in Nepal, where I did a Buddhist studies program. And also I prepared a little talk, maybe for, because that's so much in the room too, I wonder if there's any questions, general questions you're having about my time in Nepal that just answer first. Yeah. Yeah.
Of everything that you saw and heard and experienced, what opened your heart the most?
What opened me the most, the two things. One is copious, consistent faith of Skyping me for 8 months, and the kind of trust and friendship is really precious. And the other is consistent guidance in my study, where the teacher and abbot of the monastery I was studying in, he consistently said the word, you have to apply it to your heart. You keep applying it to your heart. If you don't apply it to your heart, it doesn't make any sense. So I think that opened me the most, because then I could allow things to just fall away of what I heard, and just really that what hit me, just let it sit there and work on me. And that guidance, I think, helped me allow the heart, because in all the experiences that I had, there were some confusing ones of seeing the Nepali culture or Tibetan culture, the way they organize themselves was very strange for the first 5 months. I had a very resistance to it, and finally were able to open. So to just stay there and let the few moments as a beggar just touch me, and not try to make something out of it, or just let the teaching I heard in class, you know, just a little sentence touch me, and not worry about the whole other rest of the... So that guidance was very helpful in maneuvering and letting my heart open. But yeah, I think so it's this backbone of a relationship and a connectivity that I felt through Kokyu and through Facebook to this community, and having the backbone of where I'm coming from the practice field, and meeting the new one with the instruction to just let it touch your heart, let it stay with that. There were a lot of 20-year-old students coming from, like, the community was like half U.S. Students, people from the U.S., half Europe, South America, Canada. So it was a very international group of students, many in their 20s, many coming from Tibetan practice centers and really coming to wanting to learn Tibetan. That's like the main offering this school offers, because you can talk with people while you learn the script, and so many people want to become translator. And it's in like a normal university undergraduate program, so many people in the undergraduate age. But there was like a small group, one-fourth, one-third of people like my age who had like they had a job or they had family and things fell apart and they had found a practice teacher or community that they felt drawn to and they wanted to go deep in it. So that was like this group of people of, you know, 30, 40 year old, some in the 50s, who just, you know, I'm just here to wanting to deepen my understanding of Dharma. So and then there was like the core group of the school, and then that surrounded, like in the beginning I thought, oh, every Westerner must be going to the same school that I saw in Boulder, that's a part of Kathmandu where it was. But actually there were so many Westerners coming through that area, and many just said, no, this teacher and that teacher and that monastery. So this was just a group of people who were also associated with that monastery. And then there were other students who went to other monasteries doing the same kind of study. I think the uniqueness of the school I went is that you can earn your undergraduate or your master's in that school. And other schools are maybe not that set up. They're just offering Dharma. So in this way, I also just plainly working on my VA. I felt really blessed to have found like a very sweet rooftop apartment. So I was a little outside the general monastery Boulder area, and was very quiet. So I wasn't woken up at 5 o'clock by a monastery bell, which everybody else was. And this way I did woke up between 6 and 7. And I did my morning routine of sitting, and mostly my classes started at 9:15 and went to 12:30. So I mostly had two sets of classes then, and another two sets of classes in the afternoon. I got like around 21 hours of classes during the semester, one semester. And there was a lot of reading to do and a lot of vocabulary learning. I'm not very good in language learning, so I took just one class each semester of language, one Tibetan, one Nepali class, and very slowly like tried to learn the vocabs. So there was a lot of book reading for three philosophy classes and then one language class each semester. And the way I'm saying that, because it pretty much occupied my free time. So if I had like around 20 hours of classes during a week, going Monday to Friday, I was doing reading and vocab learning the rest of the time. And I tried to make a point to go one a day to the stupa. This is like this huge Buddha stupa, which you probably saw in many, many pictures, or have been there yourself. And there I always met a Tibetan community doing their practice, and I just joined in that river. So for at least an hour a day or so. So yeah, in the evening I would sit again, and then I would always have also half an hour a day of email or Facebook connections. And weekends I would prepare papers, once a week I would go out with friends to a restaurant. If I look back, I was like 9 months in half a mile square, pretty much. I was staying in that Boulder area, and followed the study schedule, which is, you know, coming from you who have been in Tassajara, it's kind of like that. I mean, it's like not much free time and just follow the schedule. And there was a lot of internal, like, resistance and joy just going. I mean, in the beginning I was mostly resisting because it was all too weird. But I think by the end, like the last second semester, I really loved it. I loved the study, I loved being there, I loved the people, even so, you know, they're all, obviously everybody's suffering. But there was some love transformation happening there, just due to maybe either getting used to the strangeness of it or just because the teachings were really, really opening my heart in a way. Or, I think mostly, yeah, because I really saw that my mind got transformed, even though the schedule was just very boring in a way from external, just saying, well, I just read and I just ate and I sat and that was it. But there was something happening there. There were always on my house, I heard various bells around me of other practitioners, because in the Tibetan practice you have a bell and a dorje. That's what you do. So you hear your neighbors practicing, you know, it's just so beautiful. And then doing around Kora, which is going around the stupa, hundreds of people every day. And you can see that really it's important to them. However, going through academia, the whole thing was set up two ways. So on one side, you get the internal view, the Tibetan presentation, where you are going through the training that Lama Tarchin maybe described of like, you know, there is birth and death, period, you know, and there is rebirth, and there is there are devas, and there are, you know, I mean, there's a certain structure to the present Tibetan presentation, and we were told just, you know, sit, receive it, you know, and you can ask questions, but you can't ask the teacher, the Lupon, which was a monk, ask questions about science because that's not his training, you know? I mean, it's just a very system that's enclosed there. And of course people ask questions about science because we are Westerners, right? And he was trying, but you could see it was kind of different because he kind of just came from his upbringing, which was this enclosed training method. That's a training method, all these teachings. And that opened his mind, and then you sit there and you hear his explanations that are very kind, very wise, and very, I mean, he is 32, you know, and it's like, whoa, about this person, he is like so wise. But it came through the method of that training he had from being very small and memorizing teachings. And so that was this one part of presentation at school, and that aligned with what I saw people were doing on the stupa, because that's kind of the Tibetan belief. And like, if you have a problem, you go to a lama, you get pills to eat, like various magic remedies. It's kind of like a little bit like shamanistic, you know? And then you get a deity to pray to as a remedy for your practice question. And so it's a different approach, and it's very, it's coming from the Tibetan culture of living in mountains and living with deities and living with a teaching understanding, I think, that's woven in over centuries between, you know, shamanistic sorcery and emptiness teachings and philosophy teachings. So there's something crew there, that's a method. And so the other presentation, I had two other philosophy classes each semester that were Western academia. So Western academia is questioning, right? Like, you had to write an essay about, well, is there rebirth? Why would you think so, you know? Or is there, you know, do you really think going to a lama and getting pills would help you? Why would a pill help you with, you know, your depression or whatever, you know? I mean, it's like asking questions. And you're trained to ask questions, and that seems to be like the main method of academia. It's like you want to train your mind asking questions, and the more questions you ask, the more you're actually opening your mind and transforming your mind too, you know? I mean, it's, and so in this way, yeah, I did meet that, what Lama Tarchin was saying, but I also met this incredibly beautiful encouragement that Western academia has, which is analysis. You analyze and you compare, and you use tools and you differentiate the tools. And so most of it was philosophy. So philosophy, I really saw, it's not about gaining anything. It really is about learning to think. And I love it. There's something about that where I feel it goes very back to what we're doing here, why we came here, you know, or why are we practicing? Because you have questions. So I think academia goes really well with Buddhist studies. And that's where I also felt, as Westerner, I found my place of having have science have its place, science having its offer, having an not having to believe in deities or spirits or rebirth, or, you know, there's a certain, because if you hold a question, it's going to answer itself, but you just have to really hold the question, and you have to hold the question in a skillful way, and not jump to conclusions too early. And learning that is really hard, because we always want to know something. So what I thought I wanted to talk about briefly was bodhicitta. And so maybe that's staying in that vein between these two realms of presentations, because in the Tibetan tradition, which is like, you know, there's a historical event that's of course questioned by academia, history, if that really happened, between the graduate school and the Sutton school, they had a debate, and so Tibet like decided we wanted to have gradual approach to enlightenment versus like China and then Japan very much had, they had also their gradual Sutton debates over there. But one thing I found interesting, I would like to share, because I just like it. I like those revelations. So when at the time, I mean, the time when our founder of the school, Dogen, when he was in, went to China, that was actually pretty late, right? It was like 1,700 years later after the Buddha had his enlightenment. And so, and at that time there was a lot of tantric Buddhism going on in Japan. And so he went over, and a whole bunch of people at that time went over to China to check out their sponsor, and the sponsor wanted them to found an authentic school to bring back, or authentic teachings to bring back, and then schools would start out of that. So Dogen was one of these people who went to China to find something. And so the interesting thing was that he went to China at a time that was like 400 years before there was persecution going on. And so there were a lot of persecution going on in China. They were like, you know, and some of you might a bit know, but so anyhow, there was these various kings and emperors in China, and then they supported Confucianism, and then they needed to get rid of Buddhism, and then they favored Buddhism again, and then they built temples and things. So anyhow, there was like one this period where like Buddhism got persecuted, and it was a really, really heavy persecution because a lot of texts and temples got destroyed. That was just pretty much, I mean, 400 years is not much. So all these people went into the mountains, and what they did was like, well, you know, we don't have any books, or we don't need them. We are going to be the school outside the scriptures. I mean, in a way, that's like the way to survive. What you're going to do if you don't have any text? You're going to be the school outside of scriptures, and you have your method how you're going to like do that. And so one of these school, I mean, there was, you know, various trends and various, I'm totally oversimplifying, right? But there were various schools, and so one of which was which Dogen, our founder, met and brought back. And so there you also had to struggle for support and so forth. So I just wanted to share because it was so revealing to me how politics and social structure actually contribute to the perseverance and formance of doctrine, you know. I mean, how they interplay. So anyhow, I was going like, oh, I want to talk about bodhicitta because it was a main theme that constantly popped up in my studies in Nepal. And so I was like, well, Dogen has two articles about it in his Shobo Genso, so what he's going to say now. And I have to say, I'm looking into these two essays, and it's kind of fascinating. You know them. I want to name you the title. Ho Boshin, Hotsu Bodaishin and Hotsu Muchushin. So it's like these two essays about arousing the mind of enlightenment. And in his presentation, Dogen, I found like if I look at it coming now from reading all these texts about bodhicitta that are very structural oriented and very gradual oriented, like in the Tibetan tradition, like some of you already all know, there's the very gradual way of, okay, there's relative bodhicitta and there's absolute bodhicitta, and you reach the absolute one, which is like emptiness or the insight into emptiness, by developing relative bodhicitta. And relative bodhicitta are methods. So these are various methods of compassion practices and wisdom practices to develop a mind that can see emptiness. So you like totally start by acknowledging that one is a confused sentient being, and one needs to remove the obscurations, or to be and see emptiness directly. And so relative bodhicitta and the practices of relative bodhicitta are helping you to do that. And then the concept of accumulating merit very much comes into play. So accumulating merit is the concept of merit is the result of virtuous activity. So there are three bases. It's giving and virtuous actions and mental development that generate this merit. And one way to describe it, like one image one could draw of how that works is the traditionally that's considered you go through the path of accumulating merit and you do a lot of virtuous actions, and most of these actions are based on acting selflessly, because if you realize emptiness, you realize that there is not a person here, right? There's no self here. So in order to develop the direct insight into that, you do actions that are based on that view, like you give and you do practices that help you open your heart and take other beings first and take yourself last, so having other beings come first. And so in the presentation of in the Tibetan tradition, that takes a lot of time, and whatever, and the measure of how to measure that you have developed or you are developing this relative bodhicitta is actually pretty high. Like it's basically said to that one needs day and night to basically to think of others' welfare, and you are able to give your head away and your body away and your possessions away, and you, like all these Jataka tales that we heard of the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, when he fed his body to the tigress, or he jumped off as an elephant off the cliff in order to feed people. All these stories are like taken as an example for this is a measure of selflessness that one needs to develop in order to actually see, have the mental development for seeing emptiness. And so, and the ability to do that is based on one's merit. So the concept of merit is like basically anything that's conducive to seeing seeing one's own selflessness. You're seeing emptiness. Like everything that's conducive to seeing emptiness. And in a way, one can also just approach it this way. It could be also considered, for example, a samadhi, right? Like shamatha. Like to just follow your breath. I mean, it's a simple instruction. How difficult is it, right? And but the ability to like really not follow your thoughts and like really let go of them, that actually demands a lot of selflessness, because what's the content of the thoughts is the most compelling part that keeps us going after them. And so this is another explanation one could have for the merit or the ability to see emptiness directly, is the ability to have a mind that can totally take shamatha first, like the way to concentrate on your object or the way to concentrate on your wish to reach enlightenment first. You take that first, and then so that demands the selflessness and the wish to let go of everything. And that goes together with vipassana, which is the ability to analyze, which is like you don't take any object of your mind as what it seems to be. Like you really question everything. So vipassana could be described as just take any situation you're in and you question it, you analyze it, like, we're sitting in a room. Well, is this really a room? What do we call a room here? You know, the four walls? Is that the room? Or the ceiling? If you take the door away and the ceiling away, is it still a room? You know, this kind of analysis of what are we thinking is going on, you know? So, so those both just really magnified into a really strong unit are the condition for emptiness. And so in this presentation of the Tibetan tradition, that's kind of like, that you develop gradually. It doesn't come at once. And it's based on your actions in meditation, the choices you do in meditation of letting go of your thoughts and developing this certain analysis, or the actions outside of your meditation and post-meditation where you are treating others with respect and love and care and compassion and you are able to be very generous. All these actions together then builds this, accumulate to this moment that's called the path, where you can enter the path of seeing, which is the ability to enter emptiness directly. So in a way it could also be described of like you are taking your entire life, everything what you think your life is, and you mold it into the most conceptual, most closest conceptual version of emptiness. Like, there's emptiness, whatever you heard of it is conceptual, right? And you mold your entire life and your entire understanding the closest to this non-conceptual reality. Because then it's the easiest to see it. Like that. So in the Tibetan traditions, that's being like, it's a gradual process and takes a whole eon, very long. So now, Dogen, that's why I actually want to talk with you about, because I really want to learn from you. Maybe also because this one day of looking at him was really not enough to understand everything he said. But as I understood what I was reading in these two articles from him about that process, he's kind of what I understood in these articles, in these fascicles. He kind of says the same thing. Like, in a way, what I always admire is, you know, you read in Dogen, you read the about all the suddenness right here, right, Genshu Kho, and actualizing this moment. And then you go into all the sutras and they talk about a lot of lists and a lot of stories and analogies. And then you go back and then you find the same things in there, you know? I mean, it's like really all the Indian material is in those writings. And Abhidharma, there's so much Abhidharma in here. You go in Abhidharma, like, oh my gosh, what has this to do with my life? You go read Dogen. Well, it's right in here too. It's like the same kind of, it's here. It's just differently organized. So the way I thought, oh, well, how does he, did he know, well, what's his presentation now about how do you get to the to develop bodhicitta and get to that point that, you know, in the Tibetan tradition, you have this whole accumulation going on. And then at one point you reach this insight into direct seeing. So what's Dogen saying about that? So, like I said, he kind of says the same thing, but he just zips it together. Like, I found it was kind of a zipper. In the way of, like, there's this relative presentation of, like, you know, you gotta build stupas, you gotta do acts of giving, you gotta do, a lot of virtuous deeds. And all this is your mind. It's happening in your mind, it's right here in your mind, and it's totally empty of anything you could ever think it is. And you gotta do it because if you think that, you know, you don't need to do anything, you're totally wrong, you know? And, you know, actually never did anything ever because, you know, it's all empty. So it's like, so I could see that he's like trying to draw a map of like don't go too far over there and don't go too far over there. Don't go too much into the relative and don't go too much into the absolute. Because if you go too much, you absolutely totally lose it. You just think everything is like as it is and like all, you know, substantial things, you're totally off. You never do anything, you never learn anything about emptiness. So it's like you're just trying to sip it in the middle. And maybe it's like in this way, like whatever topic he takes, it's this interconnectedness of the relative and the absolute that he's then trying to present. And that's very unique, and that's why he's still being honored and respected up to this day, because if you study, you do have to interpret it, and then you have to, like, pull it out, and then you you have entire Buddhism right there. It's like these zip files, right? And then you unzip it. And then. So in this way, that would be totally fascinating with you to study some more of this. I have 5 minutes for questions.
Sense of how a culture and its mores and ethics and religions working is the sense of the people. Do the people feel when you're there, do you feel they've absorbed this and they have a sense of well-being and joy that's, let's say, different than something you find here? You know what I'm asking?
Yeah, I know what you're asking. They have a different culture, a different social system, and you mean the Tibetan community or Nepali community or
Buddhist
community in that cultural framework? Yeah. No, Akira was one of these heart-opening events, actually, to like see into people's faces. And I'm only seeing my own stuff, of course. But to some extent, I think even talking with some of the language partners I had, they were a part of the Tibetan community. They told me stories that everybody else around here would tell me too. I did see way more laughter on the street if I drive with a bus, you know. I mean, it sounds like you maybe have been in Asia, and those who have been, you know. I see them also clued behind the TV and behind the, you know, cell phone, and so we can check in 10 years if they're still laughing as much, because I think there are some, you know, conditions to that, to how you are, why you are. I think one big thing is that the social net is just very strong. Like, everybody lives from and with their relatives and their neighbors. There's a very strong social net, which I think is frightening us over here, and I think we are in this culture discovering how much it actually frightens us. Like, I was following the election, of course, and then all these events that happened over here, Boston bombing and shootings and gun debates and things, and I did have the thought of like, wow, people are really afraid, you know. But then I was over there, I was afraid too. Like, I went home every night at 7 at least, latest, because I was told if I walk at that, I had to walk a very narrow stretch. And when Kogi and I were there the first time, we stayed close to that stretch in a guest house. We heard somebody scream from a crime. So it's not, I mean, there's no heaven in this world, really. But yeah. I think maybe that's why we are like still here, right? Because there is happiness to be found in Buddhist communities. And that's why you're here too, right?
Right.
Well, I think in the end, all these 84,000 teachings that are being taught in all these different schools, they're really just to help and meet the person with his or her certain conditions and help them to reach the same enlightenment that Shakyamuni Buddha had. And some people say it's easy to do, and some people say it's faster and not so easy. And now I actually think, you know, everything everybody ever says is really just for you to, you know, for an antidote. And so, in this way, I don't think anymore that the sectarian differences are by any means I mean, I think they're helpful to go deeper to make commitments, you know, that the differences between the different schools are there for you to, you know, really come close to an understanding, to say, oh, I have affinity with this certain presentation and I'm going to stay with that because I want to go deep. But then you got to be also honest to say, oh, on this stretch of my path, does it really help me? I reached a part in my own personal practice where the idea that everything is right now here realized didn't help me at all. And it helps me a lot to think, it's right there and I just need to do some steps to get there. It actually helps me. But at the end, on one point, I need to see it's right here. I mean, because it's neither there nor here, right? I mean, any conceptual layover we are having is, it's just a means. Like the finger, right? And, so in this way, I don't want to build up a tent, you know. I mean, I kind of did. I'm wearing robes of a certain, you know, grouping. But at the end, it really, if I'm practicing or not, is really based on if I'm still having selfishness in my heart or not, and what addresses my selfishness. Which means addressing my selfishness. I think I really feel strong about wanting to let go of self-clinging is the most important wish to have. And we need to keep nourishing that wish. And any group or practice or teaching you hear that supports that wish, we need to follow. And then maybe it helps a certain stretch, and then, I mean, we're walking a path after all. If it's right here or not, we are walking a path. If enlightenment is here or not, it's really a matter if we realize it. And that's being measured on our selfishness. When I said I'm going to do this talk, I thought I would not be as jet-lagged as I am. So I'm grateful you're bearing with me. But it's a great gift being here, because, I mean, here we are as a group and we were here together, you know, was 9 months ago. And some were here that are not here anymore. It's a gift. I really think it's a gift to be here together. And I am very happy that we have this chance together. having thoughts, sharing our thoughts, sharing our intentions, sharing our efforts. One big gift we have from our tradition that's going back to China, going back to India, is a teaching of one taste, where like as different as we are, and as different as all these schools are, and as different as all the teachings and experiences are, there's like this one single wish of wanting to be happy, and there's this one single emptiness that makes it all happen. Like, if there wouldn't be emptiness, all of this wouldn't happen. And so we can interpret the one taste in many ways, but right now I would say it's this beautiful, beautiful, precious origin of our being that makes us be here together. And I'm so happy that we can together discover that. I'm so happy. This is really, really great. And thanks for all your practice. So wonderful to come back and just pick it up together. So I brought a little treat from Nepal. Something like halva. Similar, it's called papad. It's vegan. and I hope and wish to cross paths with you. I will be here for my summer break till the mid of August. And thank you for your support.